Next case is on our calendar, 09558 and 09649, Doug Berman et al. Versus Monarch Construction Company et al., Mr. D'Angelo.
Good morning, and may it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice. I'm Joseph D'Angelo on behalf of the appellants.
Counsel, normally I wouldn't ask a question before you even get started, but
please feel
my
free.
Curiosity is really piqued as to why Miami University was let out of this case. Seems to me this matter would have been resolved a long time ago if they had stayed in the case.
It's my position, Your Honor, that the employee action under Section 10 does not contemplate a cause of action against a contracting public authority, which should be distinguished from a public authority that actually constructs the public work with its own forces. The reason the university was named in this case is because at the time suit was filed, they had a substantial retainage that would have satisfied any judgment rendered in favor of the employees. And there's language in the statute that indicates that until a contractor avers that full compliance with prevailing wage has been had, that retainage cannot be released. And it was our goal through an injunction claim to try and freeze up that retainage in order to secure payment. That failed. And of course, that having failed, we had no other claim asserted against the university.
Is there just $10,000 at issue now? Is that correct?
I have not actually crunched those numbers. That would not surprise me if we were ballparked. It's somewhere in that range. Yes, sir. What's at issue here is perhaps the most important prevailing wage case perhaps ever heard. This is literally the centerpiece of this statute. The prohibition is absolute. Thou shalt not violate the wage provisions. And it goes further, or suffer, or permit, or require employees to work for less. There's no circumstance in any case where an employee could find himself with less than the prevailing wage at the end of a public improvement. In this case, even allowing for the redetermination, which practically halved what was found to be underpaid to these employees, we're looking at almost $200,000 in underpayments. 34 plaintiffs in this case were underpaid approximately $100,000. And yet the judgment we appeal to this court awards less than the prevailing wage rate. That turns this absolute prohibition into a very flexible aspirational goal that will become whatever the judge in any particular case decides should be awarded. We posit that the legislature very clearly gave a set of statutory remedies that are as absolute as the prohibition itself. They enforce that prohibition by requiring, if an employee is underpaid, the employee realizes the difference so that he's made whole. And that same language goes further to say that that employee should realize an additional payment of 25%. And then it finally, of course, says that the contractor also shall pay to the director a 75% penalty.
But that penalty is never assessed by the Department of Commerce, is it?
There certainly was testimony at trial, Your Honor, that Commerce, one might even say routinely, negotiates away.
It's a negotiating ploy, is it not, in practical application?
And very
seldom, if ever, imposed.
Certainly at the time of the testimony in this case, that would be true. However, how the agency empowered to collect those monies negotiates a resolution short of litigation, which of course is the goal of all litigation, should not inform when a dispute does come to court. How does a court adjust the rights and liabilities of the parties? And where does the statute at all endow a court with discretion to say no?
Well, the argument would be that the court assumes the authority by stepping into the shoes of the director.
That argument has been made here, and I would suggest, Your Honor, that that's misguided for this simple reason. There is a substantial difference between a Section 16 proceeding, which is typically how I come to court, and a Section 10 proceeding. And the key difference for your observation, Your Honor, in a Section 16 proceeding, there has been no determination by the director, so that the court does have to step in and resolve the audit. In a Section 10 suit, the director has completed his audit and has rendered his findings. If the director finds, for example, that Section 13C might be invoked, the director's indicated that. In this case, the director not only did not indicate that, the director imposed 100% penalties as part of the determination. The court does not have the same administrative function in a Section 10 suit.
My impression from reading is that some of the persons who were denied prevailing wage filed claims directly with the director.
That is true, Your Honor. There were
they did not receive the 100% 75-25 penalty. Am I right about that?
I believe testimony to that effect was given at trial. I would point out to the court that those were, by testimony as well, settlement negotiations. We should not use, again, whatever methodologies the director found to settle a dispute short of litigation, of course, under the rules of evidence, would not warrant evaluating either the value or the merits of the claim that we brought. We were not party to those negotiations. And again, it certainly doesn't speak to the legislature's disposition of judicial power.
I understand that, but it seems like we're creating classes, those who would file in one venue and those filing in another venue. And if double recovery or the wage recovery plus penalty is available in one, seem to be a gravitation toward filing in one venue or another. If the decider of the facts doesn't have the same authority in both instances.
I believe, well, again, I'm not positive as I stand here what the employees recovered in terms of penalty.
Okay.
I don't recall ever, other than this case, not collecting at least a 25% penalty.
Okay.
And again, when you look at the language of Section 10, it says the employee may recover.
What is your experience with filing claims against a general contractor for the failure of a subcontractor? I couldn't find any authority for a direct action in that instance.
There are several published cases that were cited in our briefs. One comes from Franklin County. I believe that's Cremens versus Janko. There's also one called Bennett, and I don't recall the last name, but it comes from the 6th District. We also cited a case called Taylor versus Douglas, which is also a 6th District case, but it's a trial court. But those cases each derive that conclusion from statutory language, specifically Section 6, which requires, as a substantive content in the contract that's executed, the bidder, the successful bidder, guarantees payment. Strict compliance with prevailing wage, not only for himself, but for any subcontractor who he gives the work to. And that, coupled with the language in Section 10 that says any person, firm, or corporation that suffers, permits, or requires, that language, of course, is much broader than the direct employer-employee relationship, and that's what those cases flush out. Those two provisions of the statute set forth the idea that the liability starts from the bidder,
well,
and anyone who performs the work under that contract, that liability stays with the bidder even as it transfers down. And that makes sense.
But those are agreements by the contractor to guarantee the prevailing wage. That's a different issue than the subcontractor who violates the prevailing wage and should be subject to penalties for which the contractor is innocent of. The contractor did not commit the prevailing wage. The subcontractor did. I can understand wanting to enforce the penalties against the sub, but when you enforce them against the contractor who is only guaranteeing that you're going to get your full amount that you're due, the statute doesn't seem to authorize that, and that seems to be a contract agreement between the sub and the general contractor.
Your Honor, I disagree with several observations of your comment, first of which being that this contractor is innocent. The contractor subjected itself to the public bidding process. The contractor guaranteed in contract that it would assure strict compliance of its subs. The contractor selected this sub that wasn't even secure enough to finish the
job. Let me clarify, by using the phrase innocent, they did not commit the prevailing wage violation, and they did not know it happened until much later in the game, actually, when they finally got notification. So I'm going to the issue of the punitive violation effect. By them, by contract, guaranteeing prevailing wage, they are saying, okay, if my sub didn't pay the wages, I guarantee I'll pay the difference. Do they, by contract, say, I'll also pay the statutory violations? Is that in the contract?
No, it's in the statute. Section 10 says the person, firm, or corporation that suffers or permits an underpayment shall pay the back pay and the penalties.
So we have to interpret whether that language reaches back up to a general contractor versus the direct employer.
That certainly is part of, yes. Yes, the answer is yes. And I would distinguish, of course, for the court's sake, the SECO case where you were dealing with a surety. Now, the surety could not arguably have suffered or permitted anything. They're not even on the job site. They are simply a contract of insurance. Here, the contractor, the sub, gets paid through the general.
But so, what more could Monarch have done? Because I believe there were several communications with the contracting public authority requesting and getting verification that the prevailing wage was in fact being paid. It seems as though there was some good faith exercised in that regard, and the information, actually misinformation, was delivered by the agency.
That may be true. We know in many other cases, including construction law, that ignorance of the law doesn't excuse noncompliance with law.
So what would you have a general contractor do to avoid finding themselves in this situation, other than to ask the agency whether the prevailing wage was being met and that the workers were being paid appropriately, has been done here?
I certainly would start with selecting a more qualified contractor. You can certainly come to learn whether this contractor looks like it has the means and the experience to perform the undertaking. You can also take
a
better look at—
There's no cause of action for hiring this contractor.
Excuse me?
There's no cause of action here for hiring this particular contractor.
Not at all. But they assume the responsibility for this contractor by having done so.
Well, misinformation came from the public contracting authority, though, didn't it?
I believe the rate change did. But again, since the request for payment flows up through the general, this contractor always had the ability to confirm for itself that the rates were being paid correctly. It simply didn't do that. The difference in underpayments alone, $100,000 for these 34 people, is certainly more than the difference between the next highest bid. You could say that this contractor won this contract on the backs of the employees' underpayments. That's not a stretch. What is a stretch is to take away the absolute. You cannot underpay, and the statute makes sure of it by imposing the remedies and the disincentives in the form of penalties. If you make it discretionary, you destroy the whole point of Section 10. I would reserve the balance of my time.
I have a question for you, Mr. D'Angelo. The amicus brief of the Attorney General makes the point that the Commerce Department did not make a determination that the university violated its duty here. Is that undisputed?
I'm certainly not aware of any piece of the determination itself that addressed the question of a tardy rate change notification. I don't believe that there is anything in Commerce's determination that goes to that question. But again, if I could point out, what we're balancing, who should bear the burden here? The employees are the class protected by the statute. We're weighing their rights against the contractor.
Does the statute afford greater protection for a statutory cause of action than for an administrative through the Department of Commerce?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
Can you recover more funds through one action or the other?
I suspect to the extent the director is willing to negotiate away rights and a private cause of action, perhaps brought by someone like myself and my clients choosing not to so waive, theoretically, I suppose that's possible, but you're not comparing apples to apples, because once you go to court, the proceedings are governed by statute, and the statute does not contemplate exercising judgment, who should bear the harm. It's all absolute. What happens before you go to court never sees the light of the courtroom. Thank you.
Mr. D'Angelo. Mr. Rogers.
May it please the court, my name is Gregory Rogers. I represent Monarch Construction Company in this matter. The prevailing wage law is far from a model of clarity. The lower court pointed that out in the very first part of its opinion, and it pointed to using Revised Code Section 1.47, the essence of interpreting any statute, for its decision. And I think that if this court also considers the dictates of 1.47, that compliance with the constitutions of the United States and the state are intended, that the entire statute is intended to be effective, that a just and reasonable result is intended, and that a result feasible of execution is intended, I think that you will reach the same result that the lower court reached. The interpretation of this law urged by plaintiffs is a hyper-technical, unjust, absurd result. Sometimes they want you to read what's in the statute. Sometimes they want you to change the words that are in the statute. One thing that is not in the statute, to follow their premise to its logical end, is that general contractors are not liable for the mistakes of their subcontractors. That is not there. In order for this court to find that there's any liability whatsoever, it's going to have to follow what's in 1.47.
Is he correct that the general contractors execute contracts with the subs that guarantee that their subs will pay prevailing wage?
That is.
And if so, what is the legal effect of that?
4115.06 says that both contractors and subcontractors are required to state that they will pay the prevailing wage, and that the successful bidder and all his subcontractors shall comply strictly with the wage provisions of the contract. We did. We paid.
Do you as the general sign a contract with your subs guaranteeing that they will pay prevailing wage? That's what he seemed to refer to, that you have a contractual relationship, not one dictated by law, but this is what he's using as a basis for saying that the contractor is also subject to the penalties because you sign a contract guaranteeing the sub's prevailing wage. Can you address his argument?
I'm sorry. Yes, the subcontractor says in the contract that the subcontractor will pay the prevailing wage, absolutely. The way to audit that is that they submit their prevailing submit their wage payment information to the prevailing wage coordinator of the public authority, in this case Miami University.
And what is the legal effect of that contractual arrangement in light of the statute that requires penalties?
I don't think that Monarch is subject to any penalties whatsoever. And again, the statute does not say that the general is liable for the fault of its subcontractor. The subcontractor says that it will pay, but that's as far as it goes.
What does the statute say in connection with the liability of the general contractor when there is a subcontractor who is in default?
It does not.
Does it impose the liability against the subcontractor?
The statute says that the person employing the employees has to pay prevailing wage. It doesn't say, it does not address the situation of a general versus sub in this
situation.
It does not address the situation of a general versus a sub in this situation.
What does the contract that the general entered into with the public authority provide?
That was not in evidence in this proceeding, Your Honor.
Mr. Rogers, 4115.10A is what opposing counsel is relying on, which is very general, no person, firm, corporation, or public entity that constructs, which in my view would include contractors, subcontractors, general contractors, shall violate the wage provisions. And then you have the words, or suffer, permit, or require any employee to work for less than the rate of wage, prevailing wages. That suffer or permit, I think the opposing counsel is arguing that the general, in a sense, is allowing the sub to pay less than the prevailing wage in this case.
That sufferer permit language is right out of the 1938 Fair Labor Standards Act, and it's clearly borrowed from that, and I think that you would have to make that next step in order to find that. I don't, the statute does not say that. If you use 1.47 to interpret this statute, you may find that. But if you're going to use 1.47 to make that finding, I think that you'll make the same findings that the lower court made on with respect to the three underlying issues in this case.
Would you agree if the general, in a hypothetical situation, knew a sub was paying less than prevailing wage and looked the other way and didn't do anything, that that might fit within the terms of sufferer permit?
I still don't believe that it does, Your Honor. But what you do have is a general here whose first notice that there was any problem was when Department of Commerce copied it on a notice of violation for about $770,000. That's his first notice. It did not have the opportunity to ask the Director of Commerce to make the finding that Miami failed to give the notice. It did not have the opportunity to ask the director to make the finding about whether this was an intentional violation. The world that Mr. DeAngelo would have you inhabit is that where the Director of Commerce sues, we have certain defenses available to us, but where an individual sues for the exact same statute, for the exact same problem, we don't have those same defenses. That can't be. That's obviously a violation of equal protection and due process.
How so?
Because we allegedly committed the same act. When one party chooses to sue us, we have defenses, and yet when another party chooses to sue us, we don't. How can that be?
How was it that Miami University got dropped out of this lawsuit? I think your claim is that they didn't provide the proper information so that the prevailing wages, you know, couldn't be paid properly, and that they're responsible for at least part of this, but they appeared to be dropped out of the suit with no opposition from anybody.
4115.05 says that where the public authority fails to give notice of a change in prevailing wage, that the public authority is liable for that misinformation. The plaintiff chose to sue Miami under an errant theory and failed to sue Miami under the correct theory. That's, we didn't care whether they dropped out. It says the public authority is liable for that.
Well, of course, they're not in the suit to be held liable, so, and that's why they're trying to make you liable. Wouldn't it be more logical? And you didn't obviously sue them for contribution or anything, probably because you had a contract with them and it was not a legal matter, but it was something else, business
matter. We were still performing under the contract, that's right. It says the public authority is liable. This court in Ohio Asphalt Paving, it's a funny statute because while it says the public authority is liable, there's no way to enforce it. And so this court in Ohio Asphalt Paving took, I think, a fairly logical step and said that that's a right of contribution. But it doesn't say in 4115 there's a right of contribution. This court created that, I think quite appropriately.
Rights of contribution can be filed after a judgment is obtained.
Good.
Do you agree with the Attorney General's statement that there is nothing in the record that indicates that the Director of Commerce ever made a finding against the university that they had failed to provide the information they were supposed to provide?
That is correct. In that limited regard, the Attorney General is correct. But again, how is my client supposed to enforce that? If the only way we can enforce that is if the director makes that finding, we don't have notice of this citation until it shows up on our doorstep.
I take it that Monarch did not require its subs to submit its payroll information to Monarch in order that you could monitor the requirement that there be prevailing wage.
Whether that was or that wasn't was not in the record, Your Honor.
Counsel, there's a lot that's not in the record. Suspect is reality. Is it your position that the general doesn't have to be responsible for anything when the sub has wholesale violations of the Prevailing Wage Act?
I don't know that there were wholesale violations. Certainly the subcontractor failed to pay. I think what it did was indicate that it had paid fringe benefit payments when in fact it did not pay all of the fringe benefit payments that it said it paid.
Okay. Well, your parsing the facts. My question is there no responsibility for the general contractor when the sub, in some fashion, violates the prevailing wage law?
4115 does not say that. A reasonable rule might be that where the general contractor reasonably seeks to ascertain that information and receives information from the public authority, that in fact the prevailing wage law is being complied with, that the general has satisfied its obligations in that regard. But 4115 does not impose obligations on general contractors in this situation. It simply does not.
Is that issue before us, though? I'm looking at this, the propositions of law, and it seems to me that the issue of whether you're going to pay or not is essentially conceded. It's a question of how much, in this case, as it stands before us today.
In order to find that we're liable under any section of this, 4115, you've got to find that a general contractor can be liable for the obligations of its subcontractor. Absent that predicate finding, there's no way to get at Monarch, period.
Well, but the trial court and the Court of Appeals have in fact assessed I don't want to say a penalty, but I guess a finding against you for what, some $88,000 or something.
We agreed that $88,000 and something was due.
Under what theory?
Under the theory that we want to.
You're a volunteer?
What's that? A volunteer? No, we're not going to. We want to be able to receive other public contracts, and we're going to have to make whole in order to be considered by the public entity.
So it's a practical decision not to challenge and appeal something that you think legally you're not bound by.
Absolutely. And the problem, one of the many problems with the Department of Commerce's investigation here, is that they had put the general on notice during the process of the investigation, we would not have paid the sub all of the monies that we paid it. We would have held back some to pay for their obligations. But no, what we get on our doorstep is a $750,000 citation. We weren't part of the investigation.
But Mr. Rogers, you have filed no cross appeal presenting that issue to us, and the propositions before us on the certified question relate to the 25% penalty being mandatory, and the penalties prescribed in 4115.10 being mandatory in the jurisdictional, and the payment of prevailing wage and the others. So the issue you're raising isn't here, really. We're going to rule on these matters, and you haven't presented that issue to us as to the liability of the general.
The general is not liable for the obligations of its sub. It's not liable for 25%, 75%, and the notification issue also goes away.
But you were not awarded the 25 or 75%, so you had no reason to appeal those issues.
That's correct, Your Honor. In sum, the 12th District opinion is a lengthy opinion. It considers each and every one of these aspects that we've argued here today, and it used, I think, a reasonable way of interpreting the statute using the principles underlying 1.47, and I believe that it reached the right result, that Monarch is not liable for under the 25% penalty, the 75% penalty.
You're talking about the liability of Monarch. Do you agree that the 25% penalty is mandatory under 4115?
Absolutely not. It says may. This is a penal statute. Statute has to be construed narrowly.
Well, there are instances in which a prevailing wage claimant may recover the prevailing wage difference between what was paid and what should have been paid. You agree he's entitled to collect that?
If he is underpaid by the person for whom he's working, absolutely.
And the section that says he may collect, it doesn't say he may collect a penalty. The may refers to his authority to collect the prevailing wage. And so the argument is may applies to both and should be construed as shall because he can collect the prevailing wage.
But in the very next sentence, the General Assembly used the word shall. In the very next sentence, with respect to the 75%, it used the word shall. If it wanted to use the word shall, it would have. It's intended that the distinction has a difference, I believe.
So you agree that the 75%, the shall, that's mandatory? Because there is a distinction between the may and the shall in the same section of the code.
I'm not going to go as far as you say, but I will say that it says shall, absolutely. The question then becomes whether or not these employees have constitutional standing to be able to sue on behalf of the department. And I think the 12th District analyzed it properly that they don't.
Counsel, with respect to the question whether or not the request for bids and the contract entered into after the bids came in with Monarch had provisions requiring Monarch to promise Miami University that all work performed by all workers on the project would be done at the prevailing wage, and if it wasn't, that Miami would be saved harmless and that Monarch would stand in its cover that.
That's not what 0.06 says, Your Honor. It
okay, no, I'm asking about the contract, and you simply say that's not in the record.
The contract itself is not in the record, Your Honor. That is correct. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Rogers. Mr. D'Angelo, you saved 7 seconds, but take 30.
Thank you, Your Honor. Section 6 says, with respect to the contract.
Did you ever ask the director of commerce, or your employees, to represent, ask the director of commerce to find that Miami University was in violation?
I was not involved at all in the administrative level of the investigation. I was first contacted by my clients after the determination letter was issued.
Okay, but the record, as you're familiar with it below, there was no request to the director to find that Miami University was also in violation as to ensure that they were a party in this case?
I'd agree with that. I saw nothing that indicated that inquiry was either requested or made. Section 6 says the contract executed between the public authority and the successful bidder shall contain a provision requiring the successful bidder and all his subcontractors to pay the wages. Section 14 of the regulation says that if the contractor or subcontractor, if the contractor or subcontractor sublets the contract, it shall require the contracting party to pay not less than the prevailing wage. The contracts are linked from the public authority down the chain with prevailing wage obligations. The 75% standing issue is a red herring. The plaintiffs in this case are the employees who are owed the back wages. They have standing. The 75% penalty is not a claim. It's a remedy. It's a statutory remedy, and it's mandatory. And it does say shall, but it says also shall pay, as in to say in addition to what else is required to be paid. And unless this court's willing to read may as allowing something less than prevailing wage, the back pay calculation is absolute and mandatory. And
yeah,
therefore,
but we can easily reach a conclusion that shall mean shall in the 75%, but it's up to the Commerce Department to pursue that remedy. It's not given to your clients. That's a conclusion we still could reach.
Well, the problem with that, Your Honor, is Section 10C doesn't allow Commerce to pursue a claim if Section 10A is invoked by an employee. So, for example, the 34 plaintiffs in my case.
But you could read them in paramateria, and if the trial court finds a violation, then the way you could read the statutes is it allows Commerce to come in and collect the 75, because the 75 purpose was to build up a fund to deal with these issues. And so it wouldn't make any sense not to read those in paramateria.
It doesn't really make any sense to require additional parties to the claim, because it's an amount certain triggered by an underpayment.
They don't have to be a party to the claim. If they get a judgment, then they have a statutory right to go after the 75%, because, as you point out, it says shall.
Well, in that case, I completely agree with you. Thank you. I think I'm done.
Thank you, Mr. D'Angelo. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.